Chapter 24. Faustina's face. There was a moment's pause, then Roberto, rising, walked across the room to his wife, and took her by the hand. "Here, see this beside me, Countess Siviano," he said, and led her to the empty chair by his own. Gemma started to her feet, but her husband pulled her down again. "Jesus! Mary!" We heard Donna Mariana moan. Roberto raised his wife's hand to his lips. "Why, you forgive me," he said, "the means I took to defend you?" And turning to Andrea, he added slowly, "I declare my wife innocent and my honor satisfied. You swear to stand by my decision?" What Andrea stammered out, what hissing serpents of speech Gemma's clenched teeth bit back, I never knew, for my eyes were on Faustina, and her face was a wonder to behold. As he had let herself be led across the room like a blind woman, and had listened without change of feature to her husband's first words. But as he ceased, her frozen gaze broke and her whole body seemed to melt against his breast. He put his arm out, but she slipped to his feet and Mariana hastened forward to raise her up. At that moment we heard the stroke of oars across the quiet water, and saw the Count's boat touch the landing steps. Four strong oarsmen from Monte Isola were to row him down to Iseo, to take horse for Milan, and his servant, knapsack on shoulder, knocked warningly at the terrace window. "No time to lose, Excellency," he cried. Roberto turned and gripped my hand. "Pray for me," he said low, and with a brief gesture to the others, ran down the terrace to the boat. Mariana was bathing Faustina with happy tears. "Look up, dear. Think how soon he will come back. And there is the sunrise." Andrea and Gemma had slunk away like ghosts at cock crow, and a red dawn stood over Milan. If that sun rose red, it set scarlet. It was the first of the 5 days in Milan, the 5 glorious days, as they are called. Roberto reached the city just before the gates closed. So much we knew, little more. We heard of him in the Broletto, whence he must have escaped, when the Austrians blew in the door, and in the Casa Vidasserti, with Casati, Cattaneo and the rest. But after the barricading began, we could trace him only as having been seen here and there in the thick of the fighting, or tending the wounded under Bertani's orders. His place, one would have said, was in the council chamber, with the soberer heads. But that was an hour, when every man gave his blood, where it was most needed, and Cernusci, Dandolo, and Fossi, Della Porta fought shoulder to shoulder with students, artisans and peasants. Certain it is that he was seen on the 5th day, for among the volunteers who swarmed after Manara in his assault on the Porta Tosa was a servant of Palazzo Siviano, and this fellow swore he had seen his master charge with Manara in the last assault, had watched him, sword in hand, press close to the gates, and then, as they swung open before the victorious dash of our men, had seen him drop and disappear in the inrushing tide of peasants that almost swept the little company off its feet. After that we heard nothing. There was savage work in Milan in those days, and more than one well-known figure lay lost among the heaps of dead hacked and disfigured by Croat blades. At the villa, we waited breathless. News came to us hour by hour. The very wind seemed to carry it, and it was swept to us on the incessant rush of the rain. On the 23rd, Radetzky had fled from Milan, to face Venice rising in his path. On the 24th, the first Piedmontese had crossed the Ticino, and Charles Albert himself was in Pavia on the 29th. The bells of Milan had carried the word from Turin to Naples, from Genoa to Ancona, and the whole country was pouring like a flood tide into Lombardy. Heroes sprang up from the bloody soil as thick as wheat after rain, and every day carried some new name to us, but never the one for which we prayed and waited. Weeks passed. We heard of Pastrengo, Guido, Rivoli, of Radetzky hemmed into the quadrilateral, and our troops closing in on him from Rome, Tuscany, and Venetia. Months passed and we heard of Castazza. We saw Charles Albert's broken forces flung back from the Mincia to the Aglio, from the Aglio to the Adda. We followed the dreadful retreat from Milan, and saw our rescuers dispersed like dust before the wind. But all the while no word came to us of Roberto. These were dark days in Lombardy, and nowhere darker than in the old Villa Nicio. In September, Donna Mariana and the young Countess put on black, and Count Andrea and his wife followed their example. In October, the Countess gave birth to a daughter. Count Andrea then took possession of the Palazzo Siviano, and the two women remained at the villa. I have no heart to tell you of the days that followed. Donna Mariana wept and prayed incessantly, and it was long before the baby could snatch a smile from her. As for the Countess Faustina, she went among us like one of the statues in the garden. The child had a wet nurse from the village, and it was small wonder there was no milk for it in that marble breast. I spent much of my time at the villa, comforting Donna Mariana as best I could. But sometimes, in the long winter evenings, when we three sat in the dimly lit salon, with the old Count's portrait overhead, and I looked up and saw the Countess Faustina in the tall carved seat beside her husband's empty chair, my spine grew chill, and I felt a cold wind in my hair. The end of it was that in the spring I went to see my bishop, and laid my sin before him. He was a saintly and merciful old man, and gave me a patient hearing. You believed the lady innocent? He asked when I had ended. Monsignor, on my soul, you thought to avert a great calamity from the house to which you owed more than your life? It was my only thought. He laid his hand on my shoulder. Go home, my son. You shall learn my decision. 3 months later I was ordered to resign my living, and go to America, where a priest was needed for the Italian Mission Church in New York. I packed my possessions and set sail from Genoa. I knew no more of America than any peasant up in the hills. I fully expected to be speared by naked savages on landing, and for the first few months after my arrival I wished at least once a day that such a blessed fate had befallen me. But it is no part of my story to tell you what I suffered in those early days. The church had dealt with me mercifully, as is her wont, and her punishment fell far below my deserts. I had been some 4 years in New York, and no longer thought of looking back from the plow, when one day word was brought me that an Italian professor lay ill, and had asked for a priest. There were many Italian refugees in New York at that time, and the greater number, being well-educated men, earned a living by teaching their language, which was then included among the accomplishments of fashionable New York. The messenger led me to a poor boarding house, and up to a small bare room on the top floor. On the visiting card nailed to the door I read the name E. Roberti, Professor of Italian. Inside, a gray-haired haggard man tossed on the narrow bed. He turned a glazed eye on me as I entered, and I recognized Roberto Siviano. I steadied myself against the doorpost, and stood staring at him without a word. What's the matter? Asked the doctor who was bending over the bed. I stammered that the sick man was an old friend. He wouldn't know his oldest friend just now, said the doctor. Tea the fever's on him, but it will go down toward sunset. I sat down at the head of the bed, and took Roberto's hand in mine. Is he going to die? I asked. I don't believe so, but he wants nursing. I will nurse him. The doctor nodded and went out. I sat in the little room, with Roberto's burning hand in mine. Gradually his skin cooled, the fingers grew quiet, and the flush faded from his sallow cheekbones. Toward dusk he looked up at me and smiled. Egidio, he said quietly. I administered the sacrament, which he received with the most fervent devotion. Then he fell into a deep sleep. During the weeks that followed I had no time to ask myself the meaning of it all. My one business was to keep him alive if I could. I fought the fever day and night, and at length it yielded. For the most part he raved or lay unconscious. But now and then he knew me for a moment, and whispered Egidio with a look of peace. I had stolen many hours from my duties to nurse him, and as soon as the danger was past I had to go back to my parish work. Then it was that I began to ask myself what had brought him to America, but I dared not face the answer. On the fourth day, I snatched a moment from my work and climbed to his room. I found him sitting propped against his pillows, weak as a child, but clear-eyed and quiet. I ran forward, but his look stopped me. Signor Paracco, he said, the doctor tells me that I owe my life to your nursing, and I have to thank you for the kindness you have shown to a friendless stranger. A stranger? I gasped. He looked at me steadily. I am not aware that we have met before, he said. For a moment I thought the fever was on him, but a second glance convinced me that he was master of himself. Roberto, I cried, trembling. You have the advantage of me, he said civilly. But my name is Roberti, not Roberto. The floor swam under me, and I had to lean against the wall. You are not Count Roberto Siviano of Milan? I am Tommaso de Roberti, professor of Italian, from Modena. And you have never seen me before? Never that I know of. Were you never at Siviano, on the lake of Iseo? I faltered. He said calmly, I am unacquainted with that part of Italy. My heart grew cold, and I was silent. You mistook me for a friend, I suppose, he added. Yes, I cried, I mistook you for a friend. And with that I fell on my knees by his bed and cried like a child. Suddenly I felt a touch on my shoulder. Egidio, said he in a broken voice, look up. I raised my eyes, and there was his old smile above me, and we clung to each other without a word. Presently, however, he drew back, and put me quietly aside. Sit over there, Egidio. My bones are like water, and I am not good for much talking yet. Let us wait, Roberto. Sleep now, we can talk tomorrow. No. What I have to say must be said at once. He examined me thoughtfully. You have a parish here in New York? I assented. And my work keeps me here. I have pupils. It is too late to make a change. A change? He continued to look at me calmly. It would be difficult for me, he explained, to find employment in a new place. But why should you leave here? I shall have to, he returned deliberately, if you persist in recognizing in me your former friend Count Siviano. Roberto. He lifted his hand. Egidio, he said, I am alone here, and without friends. The companionship, the sympathy of my parish priest would be a consolation in this strange city. But it must not be the companionship of the Paracco of Siviano. You understand? Roberto, I cried, it is too dreadful to understand. Be a man, Egidio, said he with a touch of impatience. The choice lies with you, and you must make it now. If you are willing to ask no questions, to name no names, to make no allusions to the past, let us live as friends together, in God's name. If not, as soon as my legs can carry me, I must be off again. The world is wide, luckily, but why should we be parted? I was on my knees at his side in an instant. We must never be parted, I cried. Do as you will with me. Give me your orders and I obey. Have I not always obeyed you? I felt his hand close sharply on mine. Egidio, he admonished me. No, I shall remember. I shall say nothing, think nothing. Think nothing, I said with a last effort. God bless you, he answered. My son, for 8 years I kept my word to him. We met daily almost, we ate and walked and talked together, we lived like David and Jonathan, but without so much as a glance at the past. How he had escaped from Milan, how he had reached New York, I never knew. We talked often of Italy's liberation as what Italians would not, but never touched on his share in the work. Once only a word slipped from him, and that was when one day he asked me how it was that I had been sent to America. The blood rushed to my face, and before I could answer he had raised a silencing hand. I see, he said, it was your penance too. During the first years he had plenty of work to do, but he lived so frugally that I guessed he had some secret use for his earnings. It was easy to conjecture what it was. All over the world Italian exiles were toiling and saving to further the great cause. He had political friends in New York, and sometimes he went to other cities to attend meetings and make addresses. His zeal never slackened, and but for me, he would often have gone hungry that some shivering patriot might dine. I was with him heart and soul, but I had the parish on my shoulders, and perhaps my long experience of men had made me a little less credulous than Christian charity requires. For I could have sworn that some of the heroes who hung on him had never had a whiff of Austrian blood, and would have fed out of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.